This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Hey there, welcome to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. Last week, I was able to share with you a couple of interviews that I recorded at this conference on veterans and sexual health. Today, there's one more that I want to share with you, and that's David Gremillion, who's a retired Air Force colonel, and he's also an emeritus professor at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine. And to top that off, he's on the board of directors of Men's Health Network. Now, we're at the same conference. We're talking about sexual issues, sexual health issues having to do with the military. Now, tell us a little bit about the kinds of things that you were hearing and seeing when you were in the Air Force still on active duty, which wasn't a whole lot because I know people weren't really talking about things all that much. But tell us about the things that you did see and the things that you kind of wish you would have seen more of.
A couple of things that are important to note. One is that military veterans and active duty military people are very reluctant to discuss these issues because of the implications that it may have for their career. Now, some of that is valid, and some of it is not valid, but whether it's valid or not, it impacts on the level of truth that a patient is willing to share with their physician. They're much more likely to conceal something that's private and has a potential mental health component to it, like sexual health dysfunction. They're much more likely to conceal that from their physician. And in doing so, they're missing out on opportunities to identify causes that may be biological, like diabetes or hypertension or medications, alcohol use, or that may be psychological, like chronic depression.
If you look at just the sexual health issue by itself, how is that something that would interfere with promotions or with your career? I could see with mental health, if you just looked at it broadly, somebody could say, well, you're a risk because you're crazy or because something could happen. So we're going to keep an eye on you. We're not going to give you security clearance. But how does it work with just sexual health? Why would somebody be so reluctant? I mean, except for the embarrassment part, but career-wise, reluctant to talk about erection problems or something like that?
Well, it is, for males, a sign of, quote, weakness. It's an aspect of themselves that they may not wish to reveal because it suggests less than full functionality. As you know, our sexual health is very tied into our overall self-concept, our overall psyche. And whether it's true that it would interfere with their performance in the military or not, by simply committing it to their medical record, as a health professional might do or might not do, but they may commit it to the record, it is a distinction between them and the next candidate who might be competing for the same promotion or the same assignment. And as a result, they're going to share that information. Now, back in the era when I was managing more active duty, there was no therapeutic alternative that was a realistic one. Today, there are many. There are pharmacological alternatives, and there are also referral opportunities to specialists that can make a really big difference. So the implications of keeping it secret from your provider are much greater today than they were 20 years ago, and that's because we do, in fact, have interventions that can make a difference.
Can you give people who are listening to this a little bit of reassurance that when you talk to your doctor about these kinds of things, that it's going to stay there, or is it not?
Well, I believe that there are two factors to be aware of. The first is that there are protections built into the healthcare system. Military, VA, civilian, there are protections built into that system that guarantee privacy and non-sharing of data of this sort. So it's very likely that it would be protected information. The other factor is that it has become mainstream. It has become more socially acceptable to discuss these issues with your healthcare provider. It has always been, from the provider's point of view, okay to bring up this issue and discuss it with them. But in today's era of openness and more comfortable discussion on these topics, your listeners should be reassured that that it will be accepted with a professional demeanor and dealt with in a responsible way.
Now, the other night at dinner, we were talking a little bit about this, and you described kind of a mindset and a way of thinking that some people who are men in particular, who are suffering from erectile problems or sexual function issues, and how it was similar in a way to the way we hear women describing how they felt about rape, the reasons for not reporting it, kind of getting back to a little bit about that masculinity thing. But go into that a little bit more.
Well, in women who have experienced sexual trauma or rape in some cases, they will often question themselves. There's a component to it, most often invalid, a component to it of guilt, self-doubt, self-examination, introspection, that has them reluctant to speak of it because they feel that somehow in all of this horrific event, they may have been responsible or may have brought it upon themselves. And regardless of how inaccurate that is, it is a private perception that they maintain that colors the nature of their communication and their choice to keep something very private. I believe that similarly, men have a sense of guilt. They have a sense of self-worth that is at least partly built around their sexual prowess, their proficiency as a male, how they think of themselves is all tied up in that. And so to the degree that it would diminish them to openly discuss them with someone else is a deterrent to them openly and willingly sharing all of these ideas, and they hold back a bit.
You know, there's this stereotype out there of the slam bam thank you ma'am and the men being only interested in their own sexual satisfaction. But I mean, my experience in talking to lots of other guys, it's not that way at all. Kind of the way that we prove our masculinity in a way is by satisfying our partner. Do you think that there's a way in that way to talk to guys and explain that you will be able to do this, not just for yourself, that this is for somebody else as well?
Well, there's no doubt that as men have become more aware of the importance of their sexuality in their life, how it facilitates their relationship, how it produces pair bonding that can have greater durability, they're beginning to realize, and perhaps have also all along realized, that their sexuality is a major component of their quality of life, just as it is for women, perhaps in different ways and to a different degree. But quality of life is dramatically affected by your sexuality. And as they have come to that realization, there is less of a macho adherence to the, as you say, slam bam thank you ma'am approach to sexuality. Men are giving up on that and going more with a holistic view of how it figures into their life, how it complements other dimensions of their life, and how it improves their overall quality of life.
You mentioned just a few minutes ago that not getting medical help in a way deprives the patient and the doctor to some great extent as well of information that could help diagnose other issues, that an erection problem can be an indication of diabetes or a heart issue or some circulation kinds of things. Talk a little bit more about that and how you can use it kind of as a diagnostic tool.
One of the things that we noticed with the emergence of effective therapies such as Viagra and some of the subsequent drugs like Cialis or Levitra is that it created a pathway into the doctor's office that had never existed before for men. And that pathway actually can be used by physicians to open a broader discussion of health. We've learned through that pathway that many times erectile dysfunction is related to substance abuse, such as excessive alcohol consumption. It can relate to depression, chronic sadness. It can also relate to blood flow issues that are occasioned by diabetes and its effect on small blood vessels that are important for maintaining erection. It can relate to hypertension as well as some of the medications that you take for hypertension. In addition, there are other illnesses that may manifest themselves in erectile dysfunction.
Now, just want to finish up and ask you just one more question. It's kind of a two-parter. What do you tell women who have a man in their life who is dealing with these issues, and they clearly, they're affected as well? How do you suggest that they respond to it? And then what do you suggest that men do if they are in the situation where they are having sexual dysfunction?
Well, communication is the key, and it is a very delicate matter for women to have that discussion. It must be couched in concern for their partner. They must begin with that concern. I am worried about you. I'm worried that you may not be happy. I'm worried about this that I have observed. If they begin their discussion with some sort of a blaming attitude or demeanor, it is going to reduce the receptiveness that their partner, their male partner, has to their observations. But if they couch that observation in a healthy concern and the worry that they have for their relationship, I believe that it has the best chance for success. Now, for the male in that situation, I believe that they have the opportunity in today's clinical world to go to their medical provider, whether it's a doctor, a nurse practitioner, physician assistant, whoever their provider is. They can generally count on that provider being well enough informed to deal with the issue, deal with the questions that arise, and answer them effectively, as well as to provide either referrals or pharmacologic benefit to help you through a brief period.
All right, so I promised that was the last one, but I've got one more. We've been talking about men, and as more and more women are serving, women are also having sexual dysfunction issues or sexual health issues, and we tend to think of sexual health issues as being just men not being able to get an erection. Talk about the kinds of issues that women would be facing and how that's affecting them.
Women have to abandon their femininity, or at least they believe they have to function effectively within the military. And to some degree, military culture encourages that. If you look at, quote, uniformity of dress, uniformity of behavior, in the context of all of that, they are abandoning the traits that they had inculcated through their early upbringing, through family members, community, and through perhaps relationships. They're having to abandon those in the context of their service to their country. And so without a doubt, they have to recapture that femininity as they depart the military. And there are organizations that are devoted to just that, helping women recover their sense of self that related to their relationships, that related to their personal attributes that they held dear and close to themselves and that were so important, but that in service to their country they chose to abandon temporarily. Women definitely have an important sexuality that is an important component of their overall quality of life, and they need to recognize that, and that needs to be a part of their reacclimation into the civilian world.
David Gremion is on the board of directors of Men's Health Network. He's also an emeritus professor at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine and a retired Air Force colonel. David, thanks so much for joining us.
My name is Dale Pazinski. I volunteer with United Way to help the homeless in my community learn computer skills and build a basic resume. I don't just wear the shirt, I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live united. Go to liveunited.org, brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
After the conference on veterans and sexual health ended, I actually found another conference that was really fascinating. At this one, there were representatives from a number of really interesting veterans service organizations. Now, these were organizations in particular that were focused on, or that are focused on, providing benefits and services to the dependents and families of service members who have died while serving their country. The first of these that we're going to hear today is Fred Shrimp, who is the head of the Folded Flag Foundation. He's a retired military officer himself. And Fred's going to tell us all about Folded Flag Foundation, which is very, very new. It's only been around for probably about 5-6 months. But there's one small warning before we go on, and that is that there was a tremendous amount of construction going on right underneath the building where this conference was. So you're going to hear some jackhammering and a couple of other horrible noises, but it shouldn't detract from what Fred is saying.
My name's Fred Shrimp. And I want to thank you for being here, and thank you for your commitment to our fallen heroes and their families. I had the great privilege of serving in the Army of the United States, and I had the honor to command American soldiers in combat. Ours is a little different story than what you've heard from Joe. We're a brand new organization, okay? We got our IRS approval on August the 1st, 2014. We just completed our website in March of 2015. We have a wonderful goal that I'll share with you in a little bit of what we want to do with our organization. I've got to tell you that our fellow brothers and sisters in arms have been an enormous help to us as we put our organization together. I'm delighted to have Christine Husted here with us today, who's our volunteer general manager, Steve Begley, who's our volunteer ops man on our advisory board, and truly a great young man who's been of enormous help to us, John Coogan, who's the executive director of CFPF, Children of Fallen Patriots Foundation, great organizations. So I guess the question really becomes, why did a bunch of 70-year-old guys decide to get involved with providing financial aid, educational assistance to the young men and women who sacrificed for this country, their children and their spouses? Our mission also includes civilian government employees who've died in hostile action in defense of our country. On 7 June 1967, the West Point class of 1967 graduated. 4 years later, 5% of my classmates died in the jungles of Vietnam. That was the highest casualty rate of any graduating class from the military academy. Their wives and their families got a check for $10,000 and a free funeral. But you know what? They made it. Great women, great children, great sacrifice. So my classmate Bill Foley, who's a captain of industry in this country, and I were talking one day, very recently actually, and he said, I don't ever want that to happen, what happened to our classmates' wives and their children again. I want to start a foundation, and I have a name for it. It's called the Folded Flag Foundation. And I want that foundation to educate and provide financial assistance to the children and the spouses of these men and women who died for their country. I don't want to leave anybody behind the way our classmates' families were left behind. So we decided to investigate this issue, and here's what we found. And these are some really interesting numbers. In the last 35 years, 27,524 military personnel have perished in the line of duty. They've left behind 20,000 children and 11,000 spouses. 97% of the surviving spouses are women. 50% of those women earn less than $50,000 a year. 30% are homemakers, and 13% are unemployed. The government has a lot of great programs, especially through the VA, as a result, or post 9/11. As Admiral McGuire mentioned, we had the Frye Scholarship, named in honor of a great Marine who gave his life for his country, that pays for in-state tuition at a college for 36 months. And that's really 4 years, if you think, 9 months of school each year. There's the Dependents Educational Assistance Program that provides a stipend. But thanks to the research done by our colleagues at the Children of Fallen Patriots Foundation, they commissioned the Lucas Group out of Boston, Massachusetts, to do an analytic and demographic study. And what they found was is that despite these great programs and many other veteran organizations, there are 40,000 veteran service organizations in this country, despite what they provide, there's roughly a $7,600 gap. To close the gap just for children requires $500 million, and that does not include the spouses. So we've identified, again in concert with CFPF, 5,800 students that will need additional funding over the next 17 years, and it's the goal of the Folded Flag Foundation to raise $100 million to fill that gap. So our mission, clearly stated, is to provide scholarships and educational grants to the spouses and children of United States military or government personnel who've lost their lives as a result of hostile or terrorist action or as a result of non-hostile events as defined by the Department of Defense. What makes us different in our structure, and I think Congressman Zicke referred to it earlier, is 100% of all donations go directly to the families helped by the Folded Flag Foundation. All of our operational administrative costs are paid for by our corporate sponsors, Black Knight Financial Services and ServiceLink. From the date that we got our IRS approval, which was 8/1/2014, to date we've raised $3.6 million in cash and pledges from our corporate sponsors. It is a credit to Bill Foley and his vision. It's a credit to our Board of Trustees. It's a credit to all of the veterans organizations that work in this field. I am so impressed by what Ed and his organization do. And being an old airborne ranger, I'm awfully impressed by what Admiral McGuire and his Special Operations Foundation have done as well. So my classmate, Al Nahas, put together a book called Warriors Remembered, Vietnam Veterans Welcome Home. And when he retired from the service as an infantryman, a colonel, two tours in Vietnam, Purple Heart, he traveled the country, went to every state, took pictures of the Vietnam veterans' memorials in each state. And then he put this book together where he picked two memorials from each state, and he dedicated it to the 30 members of our class, three of whom were my company mates, one of whom was my roommate, that died in Vietnam. There is a prayer, and you'll note, and again, you'll note that on the cover of that book is the Vietnam Veterans Memorial from Montana. There is a prayer called A Prayer for Soldiers, and I'd like to leave you with this. Brave warriors, should fate find us in battle, may our cause be just. May our leaders have clear vision. May our courage not falter. May we be triumphant and earn victory as we show mercy to our enemies. May our efforts bring lasting peace. May our sacrifice be always appreciated by those we serve. May we return to our loved ones unharmed. Should we be harmed, may our wounds heal. And should we perish in the struggle, May God embrace us and find for us a place in his kingdom. I would conclude my presentation then with this line from that prayer. May our sacrifice be always appreciated by those we serve. That's our mission, to show our appreciation to the families of the men and women of our great armed services who've paid the ultimate price to defend this great nation. Thank you.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Broad, and guess what? It's time for a Parents at Play segment. You know, matching games in various forms have been around forever, and with good reason. They're easy to play, they're fun, they don't usually take a lot of time, and they help build memory and pattern skills. This week, we're going to take a look at a few new games that add new and colorful twists to the old classic. First up is Color Clash from Blue Orange. In Color Clash, each of the 36 playing tiles has three attributes. There's the color of the chameleon in the middle, they all have a chameleon, the color of the word, red, blue, green, etc., that's written in a ring around the chameleon, and the color of the letters that make up the word. What I mean by that is that the word green might be written in blue letters. Color Match comes with instructions for 8 separate games, including 2 that are excellent for solo players, but there's also nothing to stop you from making up your own rules. One of our favorites was to start with all of the tiles face down. Players take turns flipping over a tile while the other ones say out loud the color of the word, not the color of its name. It's not easy. It's for 1 to 8 players for ages 7 and up, and you can get more information at blueorangegames.com. Next, we've got Cup a Cup from R&R Games. It's another deceptively easy game. Cup a Cup comes with 9 plastic cups. On the bottom of each is one of 3 shapes, a square, a circle, or a triangle, in one of 3 colors, blue, red, or yellow. Now, there's a pair of dice also that have the same shapes and colors on them. Players take turn rolling the dice, then everybody lunges for the cups at the same time, and the cups are arranged bottom up so that you can see the colors and shapes in a frenzied attempt to complete the set. Some are pretty easy. For example, if you roll 2 blue triangles, you have to grab the cup with the blue triangle. If you roll 2 shapes with the same color, you need to grab the one cup with the one that's missing. It starts getting harder when neither the shapes nor the colors on the dice match. Say a blue circle and a yellow square. Well, we'll leave it to you which one you need. The first player to collect 3 cups wins. It's for 3 to 5 players, ages 6 and up. And don't sneer at that. I'll tell you, kids are usually much better at this than adults. You can get some more information on this one at rnrgames.com. That's R-N-R. Next up, we've got Pluckin' Pears, also from R&R Games. This one starts off pretty easy. You just lay out 11 cards. Each one has a photograph on it, right on the table in front of everybody. And then, working individually, you start writing down matching pairs using any criteria you want. For example, a red bell pepper might match up with a red phone because both colors match. But that same red bell pepper might match up with a pocket watch. Wait, what? They both have stems. Similarly, an ant might go with a bird, or both animals, or a roll of tape, because they tend to stick together. When the 90-second timer runs out, players take turns explaining their pairs. If 2 or more people have the same pair, both score a point. If no one else has the same pair, it scores 0. We also reverse the scoring at one point so that only pairs that no one else had score, and the other ones don't. It's for 3 to 8 players, ages 12 and up. And finally, there's Slideways from R&R Games. This is essentially a 4x4 version of tic-tac-toe, but with the added complexity of being able to slide the rows around. The game consists of 4 movable rows, each with 4 triangle-shaped tiles that can show red, blue, or gold on them, depending on how you flip it. Players alternate flipping tiles, trying to get 4 in a row, horizontally, vertically, or diagonally, just like in the regular game. And just when you're getting close, someone slides a row and messes everything up. Requires strategy, logic, and a sense of humor. It's for 2 to 3 players ages 8 and up, and again, that one is from R&R Games. We'll be back next week with another Parents at Play segment, or an Ask Mr. Dad segment. But wait, don't go yet, because there's a lot more positive parenting coming up.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
You must be your fairy godmother. Yes.
It doesn't take a fairy godmother to tell you that the right fit means everything.
Good heavens, child. You can't go in that.
Children under 4'9" need to be in a booster seat because they aren't ready for adult safety belts alone. Many parents miss the important step of booster seats.
Maybe you better explain things to him.
Booster seats raise your child up so that a safety belt designed for adults will fit and protect them properly.
Oh, that does make a difference.
Remember that 4'9" is the magic number. And get your little pumpkin there safely in a booster seat.
Hop in, my dear. Oh, thank you.
And like Cinderella, you can live happily ever after.
It's like a dream. A wonderful dream come true.
For more information, visit boosterseat.gov. This has been a message from the U.S. Department of Transportation and the Ad Council.
Now, get ready for more positive parenting with Armin Brott from the MrDad.com radio network.
Hi there, welcome back to Positive Parenting. This is the second part of today's show on AFN, and I'm Armin Brott. You know, driven by the assumption that brain growth was almost complete by the time a child reached puberty, scientists believed for many, many years that the adolescent brain was essentially an adult one, only it had fewer miles on it. The problem with that assumption, though, is that it was all wrong. Very, very wrong. There are a lot of other misconceptions and myths about the teenage brain and teenage behavior, and they're just so much a part of everything that we believe about teenagers. Teens are impulsive. They're emotional because of surging hormones. They're rebellious and oppositional because they want to be difficult or different. And if teenagers occasionally drink too much alcohol without their parents' consent, well, yeah, their brains are resilient, so they'll certainly rebound without suffering any permanent effects. Another assumption is that the die is cast at puberty. Whatever your IQ or apparent talents are, whether it's math or science or language or something, you stay that way for the rest of your life. Again, all wrong. The teen brain is truly at a very special point in development. There are some unique vulnerabilities of this age window, but there are also the ability to harness exceptional strengths that fade as we enter adulthood. I'm Armin Brott. We'll start talking about the ins and the outs of teenage brains with a neuroscientist and a mother of teenagers when Positive Parenting continues right after this.
I'm in almost every school bus and classroom.
You see me around the neighborhood, and you tell me that I'm a pretty good kid.
Well, I'm one out of every 5 children in America, and I'm struggling with hunger.
Please visit feedingamerica.org today and find your local food bank for ways to help.
Every dollar you donate helps provide 8 meals for kids like me.
We are Feeding America, brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Frances Jensen, who is a neuroscientist, and she's the chair of the Department of Neurology at the University of Pennsylvania, and she's the author of The Teenage Brain, a Neuroscientist's Survival Guide to Raising Adolescents and Young Adults. Frances, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's great to have a chance to chat.
So you talk about, at the very beginning of the book, about how until fairly recently, people kind of just thought that the teenage brain was the same as any other brain, that it just stopped growing after a while. And how did the news come out that the teenage brain actually continues to grow, and so do adult brains for that matter?
Yes. Well, probably only in the last 10 to maybe most 15 years has really the adolescent brain be much of a subject of research focus. It had been mostly on the very young brain. You know, we know a lot about early enrichment programs as a result of that, and also on the elderly brain, obviously a lot of studies on dementia, et cetera. So it hadn't actually been a focus. And then over sort of in the early 2000s, there was an interest in what's going on in the teen brain. And it really came at the time there was a lot of work coming out of animal studies, but also what sort of revolutionized it, I think, was this advanced imaging, something called we call functional MRI, where you can actually see in humans using MRI sort of different parts of the brain turn on that are connected to each other. We call it, you know, regions that wire together, fire together, and they, you know, you can see them turn on sequentially as somebody's going about a motor task or a thought process. And that was the thing that really began to show that the way that children and teenagers connect their brain parts together during a task is not the same as the adult. And in fact, they were not as well connected as an adult brain. And that process of connecting brain regions goes from the back of the brain to the front. So the very last places to come on with high functioning connections is this frontal lobe, of course, and that's, of course, the seat of empathy, judgment, impulse control, all those good things that adolescents are a bit challenged by.
So it makes you wonder why we allow them to vote at 18.
Well, they're about 80 to 90% of the way, of course, at that point. They can reason very well when they're given time. Believe it or not, the adolescent brain can learn faster than the adult brain, and actually children can learn even faster than the adolescent. So we call this synaptic plasticity, meaning your brain cells connect to each other with something called synapses, little areas where the two cells touch. And if you keep using a particular connection, that synapse grows in size. And once it's a very much larger synapse, it actually causes a stronger signal. So that's what we think is memory. So when you're practicing and learning a motor task or memorizing something, you're actually growing the size of a synapse in a particular pathway. And it turns out that children do this unbelievably well because they have high levels of all the proteins that are necessary to build that bigger synapse. But adolescents are not quite as good as kids, but they're definitely better than adults, and because they still have higher levels of the proteins that are necessary for this kind of learning. So you'll see that adolescents actually can learn very well, and this is why they can do, you know, extremely well on standardized testing, for instance, and really reason through things when they're given time. However, because of what I said about the connections, how brain areas connect to each other, it turns out they don't have as ready, quick access to their frontal lobes. They've definitely got frontal lobes. They're just not able to connect to them fast. And that is because our brain areas connect to each other through fibers, through tracks that go from one side of the brain to the other, from the back to the front. And just like a telephone wire, that needs insulation. So the insulation that we have in our brains is not, of course, stuff that's around a telephone wire. It's something called myelin. It's a fatty substance. It's
right.
Like tiny little cells. And that process takes about 20 to 25 years to complete all the miles of connections that you have in your brain. Your frontal lobe, so the myelination to the frontal lobe is the last thing. And that's what happens sort of in the late teens and early 20s.
Now, are there things that we can do? I mean, you mentioned having the proteins. Are there things that we can do as young adults or as even older adults to increase the amount of proteins that we've got, or to do something that can help with the brain? I mean, that's, people are always talking about brain exercises and all that kind of stuff.
Exactly. So imagine we're building a synapse because we're using that pathway a lot. We're using that connection between two cells a lot. So what happens is, because of the activation, signals are sent, bring more protein to develop a bigger synapse here to this place. And so up comes the cell response and sends all these proteins to be at the ready because you've just memorized something. And now it's easier to memorize the next thing because you already have a lot of these proteins up at the synapse to allow you to be plastic. So it's kind of like the more you learn, the more you learn. And this also, for our older adults who might be listening, is one of the key features of how to keep an elderly brain or an aging brain healthy, is to stay active, keep it active, because the more you keep those pathways going, the easier it is to learn the next thing.
Okay. And is that something that you can apply to kids as well as adults?
Absolutely. And since these kids and adolescents are going through a window where it's actually easier for them to learn because they have more of the machinery to learn, if you will, it is actually a golden opportunity time to work on your strengths and kind of correct your weaknesses. We try to get the word out to the adolescents that kind of like seize the day. Use this time, this wonderful time in your life, to sort of build a scaffold for your brain, because it's never going to be easier than it is at this time. It's going to get progressively harder as you go into adulthood. Of course adults can learn. I hope. I like to think I learn, even on a daily basis. But it's still harder. It requires more repetition, more effort. So they have an opportunity here. You can even change your IQ in your adolescent years. It was in a remarkable study that only came out a few, like 3 to 4 years ago, that showed that your IQ, a third of the people can stay the same, but a third go up and a third go down during the window between 13 and 17. And that's an important and really positive message, but as we'll probably get to, we know some of the reasons why you can actually drop your IQ and abilities in adolescence due to substance abuse, stress, other negative effectors. The brain is very, very sensitive to good and bad things in adolescence.
Well, I'm kind of curious about something here as far as responsibility, because it's an interesting thing. You start talking about the frontal lobe and the frontal cortex and the teenagers not having that completely developed as well. I mean, is that knowledge going to be something that could possibly be used to excuse behavior, or is it actually, does it really need to be excused?
Well, I think we have to, think about, our society gives teenagers a lot of mixed messages, as you sort of alluded to. They can vote, but they can't drink. They can go to war and die on behalf of the country, but they aren't allowed to drink alcohol. There are many different parameters around it, whether they can drive and rent a car, et cetera. So it's a time that I think society is very ambivalent about, and the brain science just hasn't been there to help us, support us around any decisions. I think that we know that these teenagers are, especially teenagers who are under 18, are definitely in a rapid growth mode. And I think, I know I've argued in amicus brief Supreme Court successfully that, you can't necessarily hold the same level of accountability to a teenager who could come under the influence of, a malevolent superior, let's just say, won't know the difference and is learning very fast but the wrong thing, but also doesn't have the skill set, the frontal lobe access to actually exercise good judgment and cause and effect. So I think for the early teenagers, absolutely. Things get a little gray as you get closer and closer to, legal adulthood, because, of course, you are getting close to adulthood. However, I'd like to point out that, neurobiology is showing that for that final connectivity of the frontal lobes, that is not done until, early 20s.
I'm talking with Francis Jensen, who's the author of The Teenage Brain, a neuroscientist survival guide to raising adolescents and young adults. She's also a neurologist herself and the chair of the Department of Neurology at the University of Pennsylvania. As soon as we get back from the break, we're going to keep talking to Francis about the teenage brain. Welcome back to Positive Parenting. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Francis Jensen, who is the author of The Teenage Brain, a neuroscientist survival guide to raising adolescents and young adults. She's also a real-life neurologist and, more importantly, the chair of the Department of Neurology at the University of Pennsylvania. Francis, just before the break, you were talking about the teenage brain not being completely developed. Go ahead on that.
Right. So one of the things that I think most parents will probably smile at when I say it is that, of course this is a time of huge risk-taking behavior, and you're like just saying, what were you thinking? And so we think that the frontal lobe connectivity is a big part of that they really don't have the ability to, at least in sort of split-second time, make cause and effect kind of guided decisions as well as adults can. However, an interesting other part of research came up that there's other parts of your brain that obviously control your behavior besides your frontal lobe, and one of those is your limbic system, which controls emotions, sexual behavior, and that kind of thing. And that happens to be, guess what, not as far forward as the frontal lobes. So that, it is sort of around, the part of your brain that I'm talking about is sort of located, you know, sort of behind your ears or sort of around the same part of your head as your ears are, for instance. And so that actually gets myelinated before your frontal lobes. So teenagers actually have a very highly functioning emotional and sexual behavior area of their brain. So they tend to experience extreme feelings of emotion, et cetera, and yet they don't have the frontal lobe to sort of gate them. So this actually, I think, can help explain why teenagers can be so impressionable, you know, to peer pressure, to pressure from outside groups that we might not want them to be pressured by. And also, by the way, they can be very susceptible to stress. And stress in the adolescent years can actually increase your risk of depression as an adult, for instance. So, you know, all these things are happening on a rapidly growing brain because it's not done yet by
right.
18 years.
Right. Talk a little bit about the effects of sleep or the lack of sleep. Because that's something that we hear a lot about. I mean, teenagers are just not getting enough sleep. They've got so much homework, or they've got such a social life, or they're texting, or whatever it is, but they're just not getting enough. What's that doing to their brains that are still under construction?
Not great. So one of the things we know, remember I was telling you about the synapse, you know, how we grow synapses as we learn. It's essentially creating a bigger synapse. That's a multi-step process. You know, there are probably hundreds of steps, but say, you know, there's beginning, middle, and end to finishing off that synapse. And it takes a matter of seconds to hours for the whole thing to be done in the process of learning. So when we look at that process, we can actually see that multiple things break up that process and stop it from happening. Sleep deprivation happens to be one of them. And alcohol, some other substances can also break up the ability to, like, have that that process complete itself so that you have a nice, strong synapse at the end. We know that sleep deprivation will prevent synaptic plasticity. You know, when it's been, you know, one night of sleep deprivation drops it down. It's been seen in animal studies as well as in humans. And then two nights, it becomes very difficult to lay down new memories. There's another thing about sleep deprivation that's important is that we consolidate our memories during sleep. So if you're not letting the adolescent sleep, you're also not letting them consolidate their memories. Why don't they sleep? Well, their circadian rhythm, their biological, I mean, their sort of daily clock in their heads, which is controlled by the brain, as a matter of fact, is set about 2 hours later than the adult. So there's something called melatonin, which is this little, the same stuff you take for jet lag. Your brain produces itself, and it gets, when it's released in your brain, you want to fall asleep within about an hour. We, as adults, have it released around 8:45, 9. They have it released at about 11 to midnight. So what happens is they don't really start to get drowsy and sleepy because of this offset of their clock, which eventually returns to normal at the end of this period of brain development. But all through the teens, they're really staying up late. They can't help it. And so when you see your teenager, you know, not waking up on a Sunday morning, it's not necessarily because they're just like slovenly, lazy people. They're just trying to catch up from all the sleep that they haven't gotten during the week. And we wake teenagers up at 6 or 7 in the morning to go to school. That's kind of like waking an adult up, you know, like at 3 a.m.
So their whole schedule is off. It's not just that it starts late. So it also begins late.
That's right.
Huh.
That's right. And we don't recognize that. And our school system sort of needs, a conversation should be had about, you know, what, we can't change the school day. You know, you can't have parents stay at home from work and not take their kids until 10 in the morning. But what we can do is think about, you know, what are the most cognitively intense topics, or, for instance, when you have exams, it should be thought to maybe start them a little later in the day. I know some schools are starting to do that sort of in mid-morning instead of early morning. They can come to school, get other stuff done, but mm-hmm. things that are really cognitively intense, to be fair to them, do it while their brain is actually awake.
Okay. All right. So let's. While we're talking about things that are affecting the brain, there are all sorts of other things that they're putting into their bodies. Or I guess sleep is not putting something into your body, except for some melatonin, maybe. But yes, things like tobacco and alcohol and drugs, which they're kind of drawn to in part because you're saying of the risk taking that's kind of a part of the not completely mature brain. But they're compounding things by putting all this junk into their bodies, right?
That's right. And so the message to teenagers, and I'll explain a little bit in detail in a minute, but the message to teenagers is be careful what you do to your brain in your teen years. You have one brain. You know, mind your brain. You've got it. It's the brain you're going to live with through the rest of your life. You do not get too many more brain cells. You hardly get any new brain cells throughout the adult life. And so you want to be careful how you treat your brain because it is growing and you can stunt its growth or you can have it blossom. And so what happens with drugs? Well, a really, really important thing about addiction. Remember I said they can learn better, that they can build synapses.
Right.
You know, you can practice. Well, guess what? Addiction is the same biological process. It's essentially a form of learning and building stronger synapses. Except in the case of addiction, it's in the reward circuits in your brain, in a different part of your brain, so that you're actually, with each repeated exposure, just like you would when you were trying to memorize a list of numbers, you're instead exposing your brain to drugs. And the synapse starts to grow in response to that and develops an extremely strong memory, if you will, which is called addiction. And so teenagers actually get addicted harder, stronger, longer, faster than the adult, just like they can memorize facts harder, stronger, longer, faster than the adult. So I think this to me was a huge piece. That and like the fact their IQs can change, this extra sensitivity and vulnerability to addiction. You know how people who are addicted to nicotine, just pick something legal at least, nicotine as teenagers have a really, really, really hard time quitting as adults, whereas it's not as hard for somebody who just picks up the habit as an adult. So that would be an example. Cannabis, pot, is of concern in this regard. We know it's been legalized in a couple of states already, and it's highly accessible, but it isn't as benign as everybody thinks when it comes to the adolescent brain. Just as the brain is vulnerable to things like stress or other drugs or sleep deprivation, it's also vulnerable to a drug like cannabis. And you have an effect that's been seen now in human studies and also in animal studies where actually the IQ can drop in somebody with chronic daily pot smoking between 13 and 17.
That can drop permanently, or is that just a temporary drop?
It's a permanent drop.
Hmm.
A permanent drop, and it will not come back. In addition, in the meantime, for the people who aren't chronic daily smokers, but who just occasionally get high, in the teenage brain, in the adolescent brain, because there are more synapses, and most of these drugs are binding to synapses that, you know, on brain cells, that's how most of these drugs work. They turn on your excitation or inhibition synapses. You know, cannabis is just like that. It turns on, it acts at these synapses, which they have more of. So it stays around their brain much longer, and studies have shown it can be days before it leaves. And while it's sitting there, it is also one of those things that blocks one of the steps to building synapses for learning and memory. So it can impede in that process and increase forgetfulness and lack of learning of the things you want to learn. So, you know, it is not insignificant, this information, and it's going to be very interesting to see how this gets handled, you know, in states where there's been a real movement towards the impression that this is an incredibly benign substance.
Yeah, yeah.
It might be for the adult. I'm not saying anything about that, but I'm saying on a developing brain, not a good thing.
Been talking with Francis Jensen, who's the co-author with Amy Ellis Nutt of The Teenage Brain, a neuroscientist's survival guide to raising adolescents and young adults, and she is chair of the Department of Neurology at the University of Pennsylvania. Francis, thanks very much for joining us. Really fascinating.
Well, thank you. It was great to have a chance to talk.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.